History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. Ask a few questions, do a little listening, and we're sure to hear something we've never heard before. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Our guest today is Tom DiGiorgio, a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who did something I'm pretty sure most of you listening today never have, and did it in a plane many of you may not have heard of before. But before we get to that, we always like to start at the beginning. For Tom, that means his childhood as the eighth of 11 children.
Well, first of all, my parents came from Italy, and they came from the Abruzzi section. Although they didn't meet there, they met here in Philadelphia. And we think it was probably an arranged marriage because he was 10 years older. He had a job, and she had lost her father, who came across from Italy ahead of the family to San Francisco because he was a brick mason, and he helped with the earthquake they had there. But he never left there. He died there at age 40. So I grew up, yes, my father and my mother had 11 kids. And sometimes we wonder why. Well, my father was a farmer, and farmers always needed a lot of kids. But here he's a tailor in a city. But anyway, what was it like? Being number eight, I had a lot of privileges because my older brothers and sisters made sure we were well taken care of. See, unfortunately, I was the first one to finish high school. Well, the first boy, excuse me. One of my sisters also did. But later on, most of us got some education wherever they were. What was it like? Well, you didn't lack for companionship because as far as playing as a young teenager, because on the street I lived in, there were 54 houses. And the average family had about five or six kids. Now, we, of course, had 11. So at any playing day in the summertime, you could count at least 70 kids playing games, all kinds of stickball, dodgeball, baseball, football. We never actually had a real football, but we would find something to make it look like that. So again, I'd say that I was probably privileged to be near the bottom of the brood, as I would call it.
I've interviewed a lot of veterans with Italian-American heritage, and invariably the conversation turns to Sunday dinner or whatever Mom used to make that they still salivate over. Do you have some memories like that?
Yes, I can still picture our Sunday dinners. It might make you a little hungry when I tell you that the pure Italian dinner would be some form of pasta, but the meats were delicious. One is called braciole, and that's, in our case, a piece of flank steak. Now, that brings up a little story. When I was like 12 years old, I would be sent to the butcher shop. And I can remember just barely looking over the block that they used to cut the meat. And on the wall, there was hooks, and there was a quarter of an animal up there. And I would come with $1. And I would say, my mother said, give me a dollar's worth of flank steak cut thin. Well, he would go over to that quarter and slice a piece off, go on this big block, smash it down, cut through it. And he'd hold it up. It was so thin, you could see through it. And I'm looking over the block at all this, and he wraps it up, puts it in a wax paper, he puts it in a bag, takes my dollar, and that's it. And so for that dollar, we were feeding 11 kids with the meat because my mother would take it and fill it up with all kinds of goodies. And people say, what are goodies? Well, bacon, some kind of cheese, always a cheese, you know, Italians, and raisins and maybe some other stuff. I don't remember. Roll it up, saute it in a frying pan, tie it up with string, drop it into a big vat of gravy, which is, some people would say that was not the, what we call gravy
sauce.
Yeah. And it's red. And the smell in the house was so good that, you know, you just can't wait till that's finished. And most of us would take the bread and dip it in the gravy until the meat came out. But that's the way. So the Sunday dinner had that, meatballs, ravioli, which is my favorite. And, of course, a salad. Now, in Italians, they eat the salad second. I don't know why, but that's the way it worked in our house. But I do now remember that later on in life, when I was working as a 21-year-old, I brought a fellow home with me who used to live in upstate Pennsylvania, in Bloomsburg, and he was not Italian. And so it was Thanksgiving, and my mother said that, why don't we have turkey, which we never did before. But she didn't have the turkey until we were finished all the Italian food. So that's one of the stories I can tell you about food.
In the home, you guys were speaking Italian?
Here's how it worked. The little kids were on one side of the table, and then the adults on the other side. Now, there's a spread of about 19 years between us. So the adults would talk amongst themselves civilly. Now, the kids, you can imagine, from 3 to whatever we were, got pretty loud. So my father is on my right side on the end, and my mother on the left. They're speaking in Italian. Well, obviously, we're speaking in English. And when it got too loud, my father had a broom next to him, and he would come over and bop you on the head. The word for broom is scuba. Uh-huh. And he would say, "Sta zitta." That means shut up. And that's the first time you'll get a bop on the head, and you'll look up, and Wayo means young boy or little boy. And he would call me, "Hey, Wayo, sta zitta." So as far as the language is what you asked about, the younger ones never learned the language very well. The older ones did. The first 3 could speak all the time like that. I feel very disappointed myself for not following up on it. And he did die when I was 16, when I learned Spanish, which is pretty close in some cases, you know, but never learned the language. And that's why I'm trying to pick it up now.
There's something else I want to ask you about that has nothing to do with your own military service, but since you were alive then, it seems like everyone I've talked to who was alive on December 7th, 1941, has some kind of memory about that day and how this world-changing news made its way to your ears. Do you have a memory about Pearl Harbor?
I think Pearl Harbor was attacked, I believe, on a Sunday. We were actually in church, and so we didn't know until we came back. And we didn't understand it, really. Now, I was born in 34, so that would make me approximately six or seven years old. So my memory isn't too clear of the ramifications or what was going to happen. But I do know that there was a lot of talk. The neighbors came around, and we all talked about it. The adults all talked about it. That's all I can tell you. So I don't know, have too much more memory about that. But I do, I'm writing memoirs of my life. And my first page, the first line says, I'm 9 years old, it's 1943, and my elder sister, Marion, comes out to the door. We're sitting on the step, me and my friends. Mm-hmm. And the first thing she says is, "Did you hear that Italy surrendered?" Now, my memoir says, I wasn't sure of what that meant, but we were the enemy, let's face it. Italians were the enemy. And therefore, that meant something to the adults. And we did live in a neighborhood with mixed nationalities. So from that point on, I did start to follow the war. And I remember the newspapers having a map every day showing the line where our line was against the Axis. And so now I got involved in it more and more. So all I can tell you for sure is VE Day, which was the victory in Europe, was a big celebration. Now, that was 1945, so I was approximately 11 years old. And we had some of the best parties in the streets that you can imagine. And that's how my memory says, this is great. And, of course, when VE Day came in Japan, the party was even bigger. You know, everybody had a little stand with food outside, blaring music. I don't know whether it was loudspeakers or what. I can remember the song from Temptation, the jazzy part of it. So those things are stuck in my mind because one of the churches had a schoolyard that all the people could come in and enjoy themselves. And being that age, that's where I went. But as far as Pearl Harbor, I don't have too much of a significant memory on that.
But you also had 2 of your older brothers that were in World War II?
That's correct. And so after the VE Day, the brother in Europe got leave. And the leave was what happened, what they're sending him to the Philippines to fight the Pacific War. Another brother was just in training at Fort Lewis in near Seattle, Washington. So he never got overseas. And my elder sister, who was in front of, you know, oldest of all of us, decided, let's get a picture taken because everybody's here. So she gathered all 11 of us in twos and threes. We walked to the studio because nobody had a car. My parents never had a car. And we walked about three blocks to the studio. We have a great shot. It's in black and white with a little touch-up. But everybody's looking at the camera when that flash went off. And that's something we cherish. And my older brother made several copies and sent it to our family. So everybody has a picture of the 13 of us, you know, having a picture taken.
Did you ever get a sense of what your older brother had done in Europe during the war?
Yes, I looked it up. Well, first of all, he told me he was a mortar man. Now, I didn't know what that meant then, but that's when you see pictures of the war where they stick this little projectile into the front of the sleeve, I guess, and it fires. That's all I know, but he was definitely infantry. And I looked up by taking a picture of his patch that his company was about 2 months after D-Day. So when they got to Germany, and he apparently missed the Battle of the Bulge because he never mentioned that. When he got to Germany, the war ended. And his, I don't know the army terms, but his platoon had to take care of prisoners. And from what I read, there was 100,000 prisoners to be taken care of, which in itself is quite a feat. How do you feed 100 prisoners that you just shot at? And so that was his job. And then the war ended, so they sent him back to the States. And then he, from the picture taken that we did, he had about 10 more days, and they sent him to the Philippines. He told me himself, I said, what'd you do there? Well, what does every soldier know when they're there? They're waiting for the invasion of Japan. And he said, all he can tell me was about guard duty. So everybody had a job to do while they're waiting. The other brother never got to the Philippines. Now, why, I don't know. Obviously, he did not have to get involved in an invasion of Japan. So he was soon let go and come back.
Meanwhile, Tom's military service would come in the air during some of the tensest periods of the Cold War, as well as the early days in Vietnam. We'll hear about the unique assignment the Air Force had for him when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with Tom DiGiorgio of Fairfield, California, one of the only pilots who can tell us what it's like to fly through the cloud from a nuclear blast. At hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can find some home movies from Operation Dominic in 1962 that Tom's son uploaded to YouTube.
How old were you when you first had the thought, you know, I'd really like to be a pilot, I'd like to fly?
Good question, because I never had that urge. Yeah. Now, I learned to drive when I was about 18, and because nobody had it. Well, my brother finally bought a car, yes, 1950 Ford. So in 52, I graduated high school. There was no chance. My father had already died. There's no way I was going to college. Although I did, I went to a private school, a Catholic school, and they did a good job of training me. I get a job, my second job. First job, I was working in a department store as a stock boy. And I always checked the papers for a job. And so one said, machine shop learner, and it had the wage, and it was 25% more than I was making. So I thought, I'm going to go, and it was out of town. So I did the interview, took a test, and I passed. And next thing I know, I'm in a machine shop of a high school at nighttime from 4 to midnight, and the high school teacher is teaching us the basic math of being a machine shop operator. And then the other 4 hours, we actually ran the machines. Well, then from there, I went and sent to a Piasecki Helicopter Corporation outside of the city. And while I was in there, I met a fellow that was in tune with me as far as everything we did. We used to have lunch together. And now I'm about 18 and a half. And he says to me, Tom, what are you going to do about the draft? I said, you know, I never thought of it. He said, well, you're going to get drafted. You better think about that. And so I talked to some people and I came back. Next time we had lunch, I said, what'd you do? He said, well, I joined the Air National Guard. The only school open was pilot training. The guy who sent me there just taught me how to drive a car. And why am I telling you that? Because one by one, he and two others saw that opportunity. Now, you should have 2 years of college. I still have the statement. But the commander can waive it, and he did for my case. So we go off to Sampson, New York, Sampson Air Force Base, one at a time. We took the train, I remember. I'm the only one that passed. And I'm thinking, well, this can't be. But, you know, these guys know so much more than I do. So that's how I got into it. Still having my plan was to go 6 months and fail, you know, just get out of it. Yeah. That was my actual plan. Well, we all have this feeling that, first of all, it's 3 months of ground school. And very strict discipline, not physical so much, but very mental. All the rules were from West Point. The Air Force Academy hadn't been built yet. I get through that 3 months of discipline and all that, and then they send you to a private school run by civilians, but with a military captain running the whole show. And while I'm there, I learn how to fly a Piper Cub at first. Now, your question was, I had never thought I'd be flying an airplane. And after about 8 hours, you have to solo. So I can remember that day. The Piper Cub is very small. And the instructor, we're on a grass field. So he makes me park the airplane. He says, I'm getting out. And I'm thinking, well, he didn't tell me to get out. So what he's saying is, you got 8 hours. You're going to solo. But he didn't want to scare me. But up until this time, he's always screaming in my ear. He's right there behind you about coordination and all that, everything that goes with flying. And he says to me in a nice smile, he shuts the door, he says, give me three good ones. Now, that meant I'm going to go around, land, pull around, do it three times. And he's watching. Mm-hmm. So once I got the bug by myself first time, I said, this is not that difficult. And it went on from there. And when I was in the actual jet flying, towards the end, the assignments are given out. Well, the only problem I had in pilot training was formation flying. I said, you know, it got me a little bit. So they gave me a check. They had to give me a check ride, what they call progress check. Mm-hmm. So they got a pilot from the other squadron who doesn't know me. And I meet him at the airplane, and we're going up to learn how to fly formation. And now if I don't pass this, I'm washed out. And when you know, he's from Philadelphia. And we're talking about Philadelphia. And we're making all these maneuvers, and we're all done. And when we get done, he says, I don't see a problem. So he says, how close are you to graduation? I said, well, I already passed my instrument check, and I got real high marks. You're finished. You passed. So that was it there. So I did. And then they came around with assignments. Now, I'm telling you, I have problems in formation, right? And when they came to me, they couldn't pronounce my name. The guy would say, DeGore? I said, yeah. I said, I'm thinking, oh, they're probably going to give me helicopters or something. And so he says, you're going to Luke Air Force Base. I said, Luke, that's in Arizona, right? He said, yeah. I said, what do they do there? He said, well, it's a fighter gunnery school. You're going to learn how to shoot. You're going to be a fighter pilot. I said, do they fly formation? He says, every day. He says, they take off and land in formation. Wow. Well, I went there and I did 3 months and I got through it. And it's true. It was difficult, but I got through it. So now that's a year and a half of flying.
And what were you flying there at Luke?
An F-84 F model and then a G model. Mm-hmm. Now, these are Korean War planes.
Yeah.
And the pilots were from the Korean War, and they had some battle scars. Now, here's the thing. I started with the Air National Guard, right? Well, that's where I sent back. So now I'm back to my civilian job. And everybody's congratulating me there. I go out to the ramp where we have our airplanes, and I see two different types of airplanes. I said, what's going on? I can fly that one, but what's this other plane doing? We're transferring to that. Well, what is that? It's an interceptor squadron now. We're no longer a day fighter squadron. We're like night fighters, actually. So that's what that plane is, that one that's sitting on the end. So now I'm learning how to fly using the radar to pick up so-called enemy and make a pass at them. And the computer will do all the work for you, but we squeeze the trigger, but we're not carrying ammunition. So the computer can tell you whether you would hit them or not. And that's what we did for the next 6 years. Now we're getting to the story. Okay, 6 years later, I'm still a first lieutenant, and I'm enjoying it, and we're flying a lot. And in fact, we had to fly on days we didn't get paid. The Air National Guard is under state rule, and they only have so much money. But if you want to keep your squadron going, you're just going to have to do what we pay you with. And that's 1 week in the month. You get 4 days pay for that. And three flying training periods. That's FTPs. And we don't have any money for that. If you go cross country to another place like we did to Miami, you're on your own. Yeah, you pay your own hotel and the food. We'll give you the gas. So with that in mind, and after 5 years of that, I was thinking, gee, I'm talking to real Air Force guys. They get paid whether they fly or not. And I thought, this is crazy, you know. So I went and looked into the books again like that, and I decided I want to go in the Air Force, the regular Air Force. I talked to the commander. He tried to talk me out of it. He said, you know, I don't think it's the best thing for you. But then in the end, I still want to do it. He said, okay, I'll do it. I'll sign you off, but do me one favor. And no, he said, I'm going to do you a favor, he said to me. Can you wait a month or two? I said, sure. Because I'm going to get you promoted to captain. So when you go in, you're already one rank above what you are now, and that'll help a lot. Mm-hmm. But he said, so he got me his own, what you call billets. He got me the okay in the guard to be a captain. And then he said, wait a little longer. I'm going to get it federally recognized. So he sends my paperwork to Washington. They say, okay, now I can go. So I'm assuming, and I start to ask where I want to go. I want to go to fighters at MacDill, which is Florida, or 102s, that's interceptors at McGuire. We're close to where I live. What do you think they sent me? California. They changed to military airlift. Now, that's big troop airplanes, you know. The C-135, actually. It's a 707. So I learned to fly that, and then the next airplane was C-141, right here, Travis. In between all that, they sent me to Vietnam. Now, I flew a 123 cargo airplane in Vietnam. And it had two engines and a small cabin in the back. And we landed at these little airfields that supported the Army Rangers, who were supporting the local communities. And that's what I did there for the year. And nothing ever happened. We got hit maybe four times and never knew it. It was probably small arms caliber of people near airports. And our wings were dry. That means that the fuel was not in the wings, so we got away with that. So it was not real dangerous. In fact, when I first got there, they wouldn't even let us fly at night. But later on, as they brought more troops over and all that. So I did serve my year. I went back to Travis to fly 141s. I spent assigned to Travis for 18 of those 21 years, plus my six in the Guard. Now, you never got to the story what I'm here for. Well, I was in the Guard before I came back in the Air Force. That's where I found out about Air Force guys. I'm in the room with the commander. At the end of the day, the commander comes in and gives you everything we did and what's good and what's not. And he says, hey, I got a telegram here from Washington. They're looking for four crews. That's a pilot and a navigator to go to some South Sea Island. Now, remember, it's January. It's snowing outside. And he's trying to tell us some South Sea Island. I can't tell you where. It's for maybe a couple months, you know. And so we were all looking, listening to him, and somebody says, I'll go, and pretty soon, you know, everybody's looking, gee, that sounds good, and I was crazy, you know. So they needed a fourth, and I put my hand up. Well, now I come home, right, and I tell my wife, I said, you know, I just signed up for some special mission, and I didn't say anything more until she asked. I said, yeah, it's someplace in the Pacific. I don't know where. And she said, well, how long? I said, well, it could be a couple of months. Did you say South Pacific? What do you mean, an island? Yeah, some island. You're not going without me. The way she put it was not without me. So I said, well, I don't think families can go. You know, military people do that a lot. Yeah. I already left there a couple of years, you know. So I call up and somebody says, no, families can't go. And if you want to take them, you're on your own expense. So we did. Two kids I had, dog, piled them into the station wagon, made a box for a top, and we went. And we, first we stopped at Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to fly a new airplane, that one you saw, B-57 twin engine. They call it a bomber. I don't know why. It's a British airplane that Martin in Maryland made for us. So I go to Louisville, Kentucky, and I learned to fly a new airplane. I remember it used to rain and sometimes slush outside because it was still late January. And they teach me in 2 weeks how to fly that airplane. Now we're off again someplace else, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now, does that ring a bell, New Mexico? I mean, as to what you might be doing? The whole thing was secret. Why was it secret? It was political. Khrushchev and Kennedy were at each other for stop testing atomic bombs. Now, we weren't told all this, you know, being young and dumb. And that's what was going on in Washington, and Khrushchev would not give in. In the meantime, Kennedy says, well, let's prepare just in case he doesn't stop. So that meant the Air Force gets the word to prepare, and it's a big thing to them. So I still didn't know why I was going there, but when I was in Louisville, they told me that you're going to be flying through clouds, and you know these scientists like to know what makes up a cloud. And I'm thinking they want to learn how to make rain from clouds, because remember, that was popular.
Yeah.
They put this oxide something in there. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, oh, I guess that's what they're doing. So we're in Albuquerque now, and we go, every day we're practicing, there's a cloud, let's go through it. And everybody goes through, and we test and all that. So we know what we're going to do. We just don't know why. And that was Albuquerque. Then kiss goodbye and all that. And I'm going on this cargo plane as a passenger to I left out a whole part, Hawaii. I didn't tell her that. And when we got there, we still didn't have the word yet to test. So we were just practicing on clouds over Hawaii. We were allowed to do things like buzz Waikiki. You can't believe what we were allowed to do. So now I really got used to the airplane. And then finally the day came when they said, okay, it's on. What's on? You'll find out when you get there. So we fly our planes there. We land at Christmas Island, which is halfway to Australia. I don't know. I can't remember if I actually flew one or they got me there. So now we get there. We wait a day or two in these old barracks. I mean, with pull chain for showers. And find a cot. There's cots all over the place. There's your sheets and pillowcases. No air condition, no louvered windows. It gets pretty windy here. Just louver the window and that's your air conditioner. So we get settled in on this place and we have a big mess hall. That's when I find out, we go to this big meeting like you see on television, you know, with the guy up front with a big map and all that. And he says, well, here's what your people are here for. The Department of Atomic Energy has B-52s coming out of Barbers Point, Hawaii. Almost every day they will drop a bomb. It's going to go off over above the water. They call it above water. Mm-hmm. And you people are going to take off either before or right after it, and you're going to penetrate the cloud. And everybody said, what? And you're going to take a test of the air and bring it back as fast as you can. And that's what we did.
And then there were a few other things they had to do. And we'll hear about that from B-57 pilot Tom DiGiorgio when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-530-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Tom DiGiorgio of Fairfield, California. When we left off, he was explaining what it was like to fly his B-57 through the cloud from a nuclear blast as part of Operation Dominic.
And you land, and all we wore were the regular flight suit, lead vest, and sneakers. And I said, I never fly in sneakers. You'll see why. So after we take off, there's a plane comes up behind you, same type of airplane with an engineer in the back seat, and he knows more about the clouds than we do. Now, you know what happens. The mushroom goes up, right? And then it starts to dissipate because the wind pushes it away from us. Well, now we have to go find that dissipation. And he'll direct it. He'll say, now you go in on this heading. The guy in the back seat reads off the meters that we have. And if it gets too high, if it's in the red, here's the exit you take. Don't go any more flying through it because we're going to put you in near the edge. And I never had that problem with the needles going all the way to red. So our job only was to open the valves on those tip tanks. And we'd open them up before we went in, 100% oxygen. And sometimes you're so high, you're already on 100% oxygen. And we'd penetrate it. Didn't take long, maybe a minute. And then we'd peel off and we'd do a fighter pilot maneuver. We'd go almost upside down, straight down to the little island that we came from. And we land, and we have priority, and they take us to the end of the runway, taxi off to the decontamination area. Did that tell you something? So now we come into the decontamination area. We know the building. And these two guys on a forklift truck, a forklift itself, rather, with a platform on it, they're in white with big white gloves on. And we got these little leather gloves we fly with. And the signal for them to come to my airplane was when I raised the canopy. And I wouldn't do that until our checklist was finished. You know, every plane pilot has a checklist. And engine shut down and everything. We raise the canopy, and they come over, and they put this forklift, which has a platform on it, and they put it right next to the window of my airplane. And they reach over, and they take the navigator out first because we're unbuckled. They put him on the platform, and then they reach and get me and pick me up. Don't touch the outside of the airplane. And by the way, there's film of this. I can show you. You don't have time for it now. So now they lowered the platform, and they take us to the decontamination building. We pull up in front of there. We get off of this platform. We walk up to the door, and the guy's got a Geiger counter, and he's running it up and down your body, and he's writing because he has your name. And then he said, go inside, strip, and put all your clothes in that big gallon drum over there. Strip down to nothing. So that's what we do. We pick all our clothes off, put it in the barrel, and then he comes in and does the Geiger counter again. And that's where he came, okay, go take a shower in the special showers with the strongest soap you ever hear of Felsnapta. So you take a shower, you come back, he said, go get another shower. Now, I've only had the most two. One guy had to take five showers. So it was good to have short hair, no, but we had mustaches. That was the thing going those days. I don't know why. Maybe I shaved it off. And I finally got to a point where, okay, in the locker room over there, you have new clothes. Find one that fits. And you're on your own, you know. So that's what happened after each mission. So I did that for about seven missions. Some days you weren't going to fly because we have more pilots than you need. And that's when you would be called out at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. A bus would be there and they would take you to the ramp, you know, the tarmac. Yeah. And you weren't going to fly that day. It's still pitch dark. And we're sitting down and they want you to face some direction. We're thinking, they want to face the bomb? That's crazy. No, we're facing opposite. So we got to figure it out by navigation. So then you hear a countdown over loudspeakers. and right to, you know, zero, and then the sky would light up. And then you feel this heat on your back. Now, they gave us goggles, and some people thought that was okay, but I got scared because they told us that a pinprick, just that little bit, could make you blind, you know. Oh, by the way, I said the bombs were 19 miles off the shore. That's where they dropped them. So that's, and then you'd hear a boom, a clap, the sound come through. Some people said, watch the birds. If they stall, that's when you're going to hear the clap. Now, I don't know. I didn't notice that. So that's what you did on your off-duty hours. Other than that, they fed you. We could go down to the beach. We didn't know anything about sunburn those days. They gave us the scapular to put around, a dosimeter. You know what a dosimeter is? Dosimeter absorbs the radiation, and it gives a reading if you have a tool that knows how to read it, so that if you got too many, they would say, stop flying. Well, I never got to that point. They also gave you a little pill. It looked like a football, about that long. Couldn't be more than an inch, because I would have a problem swallowing it. And it was hinged, and inside was a dosimeter, but it was clipped, and you had a hard time, but once you swallow it, you had to retrieve it. Eventually. Well, here's what they said. Keep trying to retrieve it. Put it in a Dixie cup and bring it and drop it off at the lab on the way in. And that's how they got your reading of your radiation, which I have records of, by the way. Mm. So I know about 2 Rankins or something like that. But it's still high up in the total thing of all the people that were involved. There were thousands, even ships at sea that were trying to keep the Russians away. Yeah. All kinds of airplanes taking movies, some carrying cattle to see what the effect was on cattle and ammunition. So everybody got in the act who could in the initial stages of what radiation would do to people. And again, this is all film. So how I got out there early was my wife was in touch with her other wives. They lived on base because I think we had a dog and they wouldn't let us come on base. During the night she didn't say when, but about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on this little building we lived in, a policeman knocked on the door, and they were looking for a fugitive in the area. Well, that word got out to the other wives that my wife was worried, but she didn't want to tell me. Mm. You know, typical military wife, well, we don't want to bother him. So they told their husbands, who told me, while I'm there, you know, scuttlebutt and all that stuff. And so I got to thinking, and I did have some communication, but it was by high-frequency ham radio. So I talked to her. She says, yeah, there was somebody, and it scared the hell out of me and all that stuff. So I said, okay, I'll see what I can do. Well, they were looking for volunteers to go home early. So I did. So I was there for 7 missions, came home, went back, got her, drove back to the guard outfit, and that's where, when I got there, I saw they had 2 different airplanes, and now we switched to the interceptors, which was a good mission. So that's it for my part. Now, is that interesting? I don't know. You put that in your back burner maybe somewhere.
If you had been told everything that you were going to be doing out there at Christmas Island before you volunteered, would you have still volunteered?
Probably not. I was pretty family-oriented at that time, and we were mostly scared of radiation, the word itself. And with 2 young kids, I probably would not have, especially if I knew what we were going to do, as you said. Mm-hmm. So, no, I wouldn't have done it.
And were you allowed to tell your wife what you had done?
When I came back, oh, yeah, I think I told her everything. Yeah, I can't remember the details, but by then people knew about it because the Oakland newspaper got hold of it and they had big items, articles and pictures and everything. So some reporter spilled the beans. Is that normal? Somebody. Yeah. So at that time she was pretty well aware of it. I don't think she knew until I got home though.
And I have to ask the question, have you ever had any ill effects of that radiation exposure?
It's a miracle I've gotten this old. There are friends of mine, I mean, one within 5 years had brain cancer. Another one had blood disease, and he died. Another one had pancreatic cancer. So I try to go back. There's one living, though. He's in Pennsylvania. He's 2 years older than me, and we do go back and forth and say how lucky we are. But I am just very fortunate. Well, by leaving early, probably, I don't know, just luck of the draw, that's all. A lot of friends didn't get through it too well. But that's as close as I ever came to a dangerous situation. I mean, you could call just flying jet fighters dangerous. And that was hectic. And sometimes I have guilt feelings about even doing that after I got married.
I've got to ask you, just because I know I'm not the first person that you've told this story to about flying into a radioactive cloud. So I'm just curious, when you share that story with people, what kind of reactions do you get?
Oh, comically, they say, do I glow at night? I said, my wife says I do. Well, most people don't know too much, but, you know, they kind of think, why'd you do that? I said, look, if you want to hear the story, I walked right into it without knowing what I was doing.
Do you have some perspective on how that was used or what effect the information that you courageously gathered, risking in ways maybe you didn't understand your own health, what that was used for and what that led to?
Well, at the time, being patriotic and not going to put my nose in the business of the political situation nor of what would happen if we had to use an atomic bomb again, at that time, I was more naive politically. But in the past 5 to 10 years, yeah, I can see now where it's true that just the testing of it kind of upset the peaceful atmosphere or environment of the world. And so it's only in the past 5 years that I got concerned about that. And that's why your question of would I have gone if I'd known, probably not. But before I was told that, we didn't know too much about it. And it wasn't in the papers that Khrushchev and Kennedy were battling over stop the testing. Because you can figure out a lot of people didn't want us to test. And the way they did it, wow. So the answer to you is not until the last 5 years have I started to think about that. And it scares me as I get older that I'm afraid someday somebody's going to set one off. Mm-hmm. And whether it's what they call a small bomb, something that you wouldn't affect, like it wouldn't blow up a whole city.
Oh, like the dirty bomb, they say?
Bomb, yeah, a suitcase type thing. But the calamity of that would really upset the world's balance of peacefulness. So, what's the alternative? You know, modern technology goes on and those things come about. Last night I had a long talk with one of our neighbors about fusion and all that, and which is the next step if we ever get to a cold fusion.
Yeah.
And it got too intellectual, I had to leave. But so I'm into only the part where the future I feel sorry for. But then every once in a while you read that things are going to be okay.
Is it possible that the information that you gathered by flying through this cloud of radioactive material was instrumental in preventing future nuclear bomb deployments because they found out how long the radiation lingers or how big that cloud is or what was there?
Well, I didn't think of that years ago. That would be an intellectual question, and it would make me think of why we have Livermore Laboratory, because that's what they do there. That's one of their jobs, is to take these samples and see what effects they might have in the future. And you know, we talk about nuclear energy feeding airplanes. I mean, after all, that's in our submarines.
Yeah.
So, boy, I hate to say it, but I didn't get involved in that type of thinking until, like I said, about the last 5 years. I start to read books or magazines like The Economist, and I start asking questions of people that worked at Livermore about what they do. Unfortunately, it's only now that I think that, now your direct question was, the testing gave us answers.
Yeah.
Answers to what? That was your real question. And at the time, we were not told that. We just surmised that they need to know so that when they do drop a bomb for real, what are the chances of it not working? And by the way, there was a dud. We were all on the ramp waiting in the countdown and no sky light up. And we said, what's going on? And about 2 hours later, they said, it didn't explode. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. But the radiation part, they learned their lesson, you know, because before me, people were right up front watching it. You've seen soldiers in the 50s, or Annie Wheaton in those places. You'd think they would have learned their lesson. But I don't hate to get away from your question, because I really probably don't know the answer to what they got out of the testing as far as what they did with it. I do know that they got that sample, which was like a round filter in the center of the tip tank. They pull it out with a stick with one of those picker-uppers, you know, like from here to there. Nobody would get near it. And they put it in a special box, a metal box. They close it up, and they put it on an airplane and fly it right to Livermore. That's all I can tell you. But I don't have a good answer for your question as to what they learned from it, and what good did it do in the future? I'm sure it had a lot to do with future handling of atomic energy. And by the way, I left the part out. As an interceptor, they trained us to fly with atomic missiles, atomic in the front, what they call in the bullet nose, so that we were able to loft that in front of a invading force of bombers. Again, we're talking 50s now, when we didn't know what Russia would do. And that mission itself is scary, because we did it at night because they had to shut down the airways. And we would go over the Black Atlantic Ocean towards the east, you know, towards Bermuda. And these B-57s were used as dummy enemy. And they would be coming in at that plane can fly very high, by the way. It can go well above 50,000. We couldn't. The interceptor I flew was very heavy. So we had the dummy warhead in the front, no real warhead. But the rest of it was propulsion. And we had a radar set that would tell us the ideal time to fire it. When we fired it, we assumed we were going to be lower than the enemy. So the radar, I remember now, a dot would come down from the top. And you would go try to catch that dot with the circle of your radar. Now, mine is stationary. The dot is not. So you would want to pull the nose of the airplane up to meet the dot. You squeeze the trigger before all that. Isn't that weird? But the radar set knows it's not going to fire until you get those two dots together. Well, in the meantime, you're about 25 degrees up over the Black Atlantic Ocean. And the only thing you're wearing is a rubber suit in case you have to bail out. And you're just praying for that thing, big X to hit. And once you see the X, it means you fired it at the right time, altitude, airspeed, and angle. And all it would do would explode in front of this invasion of airplanes. Now, I can still visualize a pitch black night, no moon, and all you have are instruments. And that's tough for a pilot to do, but you just fine-tune yourself. I mean, no harder than people like Jaeger, you know. I mean, they had real jobs. But that's one thing. Now, where were these tips? Because I was flying out of a civilian international airport. That's where we were protecting the city, in other words. And, well, if the war started, the city won't allow us to put these atomic things on. What do we do? We have to go to McGuire, 30 miles away, and we have to, go pick it up. And then, that's crazy, right? Later on, I got called by a Navy group who flew the patrol airplanes, PV-2s they call them.
Yeah.
See, I put this online. By the way, it was secret until about 12 years ago. So then they called me back and said, hey, we're having a meeting at Alameda, right next to the big ship there with the...
Yeah, the Hornet.
Yeah. Can you come over and come talk about it? I said, sure. So I did. I went over there and talked to them about it. And the question and answers came up. Is it true you guys got $10,000 per mission? I laughed. I said, we got $3 a day per diem for like toothpaste and stuff. Oh, a lot of my buddies have ailments. Now, they gave me some disability, you know about that. Veterans can call an ailment like my hearing.
Yep, yep.
So I get like 30% for it. Well, I don't get any actual dollars, but they give you a tax break for that amount. So all my friends here, you know, they have these problems. And I say, where did you get this leukemia? Where did you get whatever they had? We got it in Vietnam, you know. Well, okay, so they asked me. I said, well, I was there, but I don't have anything wrong with me. So am I immune, you know, to all these things? Thankfully, right? Yeah, so I don't know, but I'd say half the people here have some kind of a problem, and some serious, you know, bladder, kidney, you know, the luck of the draw. I think I answered the most important question nobody has asked me is, would I have gone had I known? No. I think, though, we had a lot of single guys sign up.
Yeah.
And if I was single, I may have. Any event, family meant a lot.
There are so many chapters of history that our veterans have lived through, some we'd never even imagine unless we took the time to listen. Thanks again to Tom DiGiorgio and to his neighbors at Paradise Valley Estates in Fairfield, California, Kevin and Bea Olson, for letting us know about Tom's unique story. And thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.